It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Denise Lee.
Hiya, Denise. How are we going?
Hey, good. Thanks, Laura. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. You having an exciting weekend ahead of you?
Yeah, no, I do. You'd ask any MP around the country, and we've always got loads of events, community events. But it's kind of weird space for me because it's the end of the summer events, if I can put it that way. Daylight savings ends on Sunday, and there's a whole bunch of community groups taking advantage of, you know, kind of the end of summer. Mm-hmm. So it'll be good, it'll be busy, but getting out and about is what we do and it's what we love.
Absolutely. I'll jump on to gun law reform first. Now, I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on the Arms Amendment Bill?
On the what, sorry?
Arms Amendment Bill.
Oh, right. accent issue.
It happens all the time, sorry.
That's all right. All good. So, look, we're obviously supporting, the National Party is supporting the passage of the legislation. It passed its first reading on Tuesday this week. We're hearing from submitters now. Just a select group of submitters were invited on Wednesday and Thursday. It's obviously a very truncated, very quick timeline. That's causing issues for some people. Online submissions closed 6 o'clock yesterday. I don't know if you know, Laura, but about 3,000 written submissions have come in. So MPs and staff are going to be spending, MPs on the select committee that is, spending today and the weekend discussing what those submissions are and extracting themes. And it's going to be fascinating for someone like me to then hear what are the themes, what are the gaps or the loopholes that a quick legislative process is kicking up. And then it looks like we should have it reported back to the House and we'll go through remaining stages of Parliament next week, and the idea is to pass it on Thursday. So this is lightning fast process, but we continue to support the legislation, and we really hope that select committee members are going to get those details right.
So I guess in terms of feedback that you might have heard personally on this issue, is there anything obviously that people are concerned about when it comes to this amendment bill?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been contacted by people on both sides of the divide. In fact, I've been contacted by a firearms owner who has enough firearms that he's nervous about handing them into police. He will definitely comply, but wants me to be there when he does. So that's pretty fascinating. I don't think I'd arrive in that scenario where I'm with them when police come to collect. But I think it's good for me to see what it's like to have to be a member of the community complying. I guess the original question again, Laura, sorry, refresh me.
So what are the kind of concerns that you are hearing coming out of people on this bill?
Well, look, it's that. It's the process. What is the buyback details look like, you know, for someone like that person I just referred to locally, who's actually invested in his instance, historic World War One and Two related firearms. You know, he's a collector. So what do the details look like for him, having, you know, private property and invested in that? The other issue that's coming up is, well, hang on a minute, if we're doing all this and you've got the gangs coming out and saying, we'll do our own thing, thanks very much, then what do we do about that? And we've got a solution, but unfortunately it looks like we're coming up against a bit of a brick wall. So last year, and again this week, we've wanted to add in a firearms prohibition order. So the government's saying no to doing that, but we see it as a really practical solution. What it does is basically widen the powers for police to search homes and cars of serious violent gang members. So if they've got those widened powers to do that, then you'll make sure that those who may not be interested in compliance, that police have ways to be eyes and ears into those who may not be compliant. So we, unfortunately, disappointing, but we'll work through it. That hasn't been accepted by the government into this current ledge.
Yeah, I think that's quite an interesting idea, but it also raises a lot of problems in terms of, like, people who are not pro this gun reform. Obviously, this comes from a place of anxiety, and I think sometimes that anxiety is about state entities having more power and more control. So to couple both the stripping of some level of gun legislation, pulling back on ban. Sorry, I've just got...
Carry on.
Sorry, I've just got Oscar over here at the minute. You were pulling back on that, on the amount of guns people are allowed to own, coupled with, again, people potentially having their homes invaded by people. That is going to create a huge amount of anxiety for people.
Yeah, and we talked about last week, didn't we, Laura, about that line between, you know, rights, private rights, and then the new world that we live in terms of sometimes liberties. There is an area where we do have to be really realistic about how we balance rights of the individual versus rights of safety for communities in New Zealand as a whole. It's a really complex area. But I think my example about the gangs, I mean, they're just blatant, right? They're blatantly saying, no way are we going to comply. And in that instance, a very practical measure, so just, you know, firearms prohibition order for serious and violent gang member searches. You know, surely that sort of practical level, we can wade into those waters. I don't see why we should let them just, well, basically off the hook.
I think I might have a difference of opinion there in terms of, like, home invasions for people, but I might just shift on to a different subject now. Actually, no, I might touch on one more thing before we shift off. But it's a matter of this conversation raising issues of the state having a monopoly on violence. And I'm curious what you think about that concept.
Sorry, one more time. Must be a crackly line. The state...
having a monopoly on violence.
So the question is my opinion on the state having a monopoly on...
violence.
Gosh, I'm not quite sure what you mean, Laura. Can you flesh that out for me a little bit?
So it's when police are allowed to commit acts of violence on citizens for needs of arrest without actually being able to enact a action of violence in their defense.
You know, look, I don't think anyone's advocating for the state to have a monopoly on violence. Gosh, the very nature of that term sounds totally harrowing. And that's not the country and the democracy that we live in. No one would ever want to get to that scenario. But you know, look, the same way, it's a practical, considered approach to things. The same way that we're having to be really honest with the gaps that we had, and therefore we are doing a very quick process and a collaborative process towards gun reform, the same discussion needs to be had about how we approach the ability to keep people safe, and, you know, just if I may, Laura, just keep sticking with the practical example of when you've got known serious and violent gang members who you highly suspect, and it wouldn't be without without warrant, suspect them having you know, housing weapons, then why would you not do what you can to keep people safe?
I might just shift on to the end-of-life choice bill. So you were on the Justice Committee for this, weren't you?
Now, not quite. So I was on the Justice Committee yesterday for this. So I'm not on the Justice Committee as a permanent member, but yesterday I was, which was fantastic because it really helped me to get a deep dive, because the Justice Committee was signing off the last stage of the bill and their commentary and their analysis before it gets reported back into the House, which is looking like Tuesday. So if it does get reported to the debating chamber on Tuesday, then it's likely to get its actual second reading a fortnight, so 2 weeks from 2 weeks on Wednesday.
And something I noticed you put up on Facebook, you seem to have concerns about the bill still. I'm wondering what those concerns are.
Yeah, so my position is I voted no on the first reading because my initial take on the bill was that it nowhere near has the safeguards that I'd want to see should a end-of-life assisted suicide regime come into New Zealand. So what has happened is that although there's been some really vigorous submitters, in fact thousands and thousands and thousands of them, it's quite extraordinary, and by far I think it's either 85 or 90% opposed the bill. Even though there's been some serious discussion for many, many months and all around New Zealand, the Select Committee went on the road everywhere, the safeguards haven't been improved during that Select Committee process. And as we went through the commentary yesterday, that was even more clear to me that the safeguards haven't been improved. It's going to be coming into the House and we'll see what happens there. So if you ask me right now, wherever the bill is right now, I would say that safeguards haven't been improved, and so my current no position stands. And I've got some reasons for that, but as it stands right now, we've got a little way to go, but I'm a no.
And so what safeguards would you like to see?
So definitely the idea around the impacts on vulnerable people. So mentally ill, disabled, elderly and so on. I don't see that the safeguards are there. Some of the other issues that I have, Laura, around undermining suicide prevention efforts. I just think there's a real irony for what we're doing in terms of depression and suicide. Today's Gumboot Day. But what we're looking at is essentially state-approved legislation that could literally undermine what's going on there. I've really listened to and read some of those comments coming up from the medical profession and how this will fundamentally change or erode, if you want to put it that way, the nature of the doctor-patient relationship. Terminating life is not what you sign up for. In terms of medical ethics. And then a big thing for me, because I've got amazing palliative care individuals in my community, but also organisations that that really are doing their best. They actually need more resources, not more complexity around what they do. So there's just a couple of the things or areas where I've got some issues. And hey, if the House and when we debate this vigorously in the House, if that all produces some really good, strong safeguards for me, I'll be rethinking.
I was thinking about this whole conversation about the option or the choice you have to do what you want with your own body. So bodily autonomy 101. And I was thinking back to when suicide was illegal, and I kind of see this as a very similar situation in terms of like state entities deciding what someone can do with their body, even with informed consent. What do you have to say about that?
Well, look, I'm all for choice, right? But in this particular bill, the idea that there's some big, wide driver truck through it gaps that leave coercion still possible for those who struggle with choice because they're vulnerable, the disabled, the elderly, the mentally ill. That's where I've got a real problem with. I just don't see that the bill can. It's not just about those of us who are able-bodied and are able to think through all the scenarios, up, down, you know, left, right, whatever. It's the vulnerable that I just don't see how we can fully walk away from passing a bill like this and just say, hey, there's going to be no wrongful deaths. The gap is far too wide for me right now, and that's exactly what submitters are saying in droves.
I'm going to shift on to our last subject, and of course, you were informed I was bringing a guest on to ask some questions here, so I have Oscar Perez with me. Oscar, if you want to say hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Yeah, no, so...
So we're going to be talking about Owen Gill and Auckland Council.
Yeah.
So, I guess...
Yeah, so Laura told me, or passed on to me, that you had some thoughts on Owen Gill, or about the kind of future of Auckland, I believe. So it's just why, first off, because I've done a 5-part series with Owen Gill, so I thought it'd be kind of interesting to discuss and hear what your thoughts on that were.
Yeah, no, that'd be great, Oscar. I mean, I've met Owen before, and I so really applaud the guy for bringing out the book. We just need way more attention and effort in the Auckland space. And even though he and I probably come from different sides of the political track, when we had a big discussion about some of the content in his book, we married up on quite a few points. And so my first point is, good on him, and we need to kick up some serious discussion. As you know, Oscar, I was at Auckland City Council before taking on this role as an MP, so for 4 years. I sat in the Super City Governance benches and represented the Mangukeke Tamaki ward. So let's go for it, Oscar. Is there any particular point that you want to draw out, or shall I go for it on one of the points that Owen raises?
Oh yeah, so I was just going to say what kind of thoughts you had specifically, even in relation to the book, or how you thought we could bring up this conversation or widen this conversation about developing Auckland, and what you the points that perhaps you marry with Owen's points, or explaining some of the things that you took away from the book that you thought were quite important steps to take in the future of Auckland.
Yeah, good. So my first point would be, we absolutely need to widen the discussion. I just think that you look at voter turnout, 38% if you're lucky on a good day. Local government elections and governance are just losing steam by the day in the public's mind. I mean, I think they have, all efforts seem to focus around Wellington, which is ironic considering the role that I've got now. But Auckland Inc. And its importance to our economy is just huge. So why we don't put more focus on it, is just a real mystery to me. So some of the things in his book that I think would help with getting Auckland's prominence and influence right would be when he raises the partnership between Crown and local, so between Wellington and Auckland. We definitely need some more deep and fluid partnerships going on there. And I think it would go something like this, and this is what I get from his book too, is that a sort of a incentivized scheme for Auckland to do well with accountability, because trust is not there, and the way that governance takes place and the way that staff handle things, the public just don't have trust, and Auckland Council's own trust rankings, ratings show that. So if the Crown can incentivize accountability and some good fiscal prudence in Auckland, then it can partner with them for investment. And we're not quite sure what that would look like, but we should be having that discussion. One bit of the book where I way agree on is essentially recycling assets. So looking at the commercial assets of Auckland and asking a really fundamental question, are they fit for purpose? Are they still strategic? And if they're not, then recycle them and do something with that capital, with that revenue, that really is strategic for Auckland. So I was very surprised that Owen went into that. Don't know about you, Oscar.
Yeah, well, initially I was as well, because it seems quite similar to kind of privatisation changes that were in the 80s, kind of quite a surface level. It kind of appears as kind of quite neoliberal policy. However, as he explained or reiterated to myself, that it is the recycling of capital in the 80s that wasn't recycled into further assets. It was just used to fill debt. And so that would be the difference in there. So it's quite interesting. What do you think there are any assets in Auckland currently that we should be recycling that are no longer strategic?
So I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, and it's referred to in his book, but there was, and it was when I was a councillor, we paid a whack of money to not one but two private firms to list Auckland's assets and... Yeah. Prioritise or rank, in their opinion, where the, I'll just call it the low-hanging fruit would be for recycling them and using that revenue. You touched on the most important point. It's not about getting the revenue, it's what you do with it. So if you're really smart, ratepayers will be better off if you use up non-strategic assets. So some of the things that they identified was the property portfolio, Oscar. So those two entities that looked at assets. They did touch on airport shares, but it wasn't ranked right high up. It was probably in the second tranche, if you know what I mean.
So would you do you think it's more important to kind of get rid of the public property portfolio, i.e. kind of state and social housing, over the one massive runway in the airport, which is apparently valued at about $1.24 billion at last guess?
Yeah, so what I meant by what I was meaning the property portfolio was probably meaning commercial assets.
So like car parks and
docks. Yes, yep. I mean, right. Even council building itself.
Right.
The actual council staff building, corner Wellesley. So that was identified there. So was following up. I mean, it sounds rats and mice, but hey, if you look at the investment, so was the council car fleet. There were some surprising things listed on that list of assets. Now, here's the kicker though, Oscar. Someone should go back and list what councillors have done. Councillors and the mayor have done since that report came out, I think it was 2 years ago now. The answer is not a lot. So if you've had a list done by two private firms who had some real common themes there, and you can see where the low-hanging fruit is, has there been the political courage to actually address it? I would say very little.
I mean, I guess it depends what the agenda of the council and mayor is. They may not actually agree with the actual process of the capital recycling. I take your point.
You're right, Oscar, but surely out of that massive list there's something they can agree on.
Everyone
sings from the same songbook, which is we need to do better, save more money and be more efficient.
There are lots of other ways to do that, though. As was in Owen Gill's book, the two very solid alternatives to capital recycling in terms of funding Auckland's future, which perhaps is how the council see themselves progressing.
Yeah, well, you can't, so if your point is, and I agree, if your point is you can't just raise revenue from one source, there's a whole bunch of ways you do it. But the problem with not going into listing and taking action on non-strategic assets is that you're never going to engender that trust, get that trust back from the public. If you're looking everywhere else, rates included, rates increases included, except for your own backyard. I actually think any mayoral candidate would be very smart to say, hey, here's a list of things that we're prepared to take some political courage on, because here's how it will be beneficial to you as ratepayers, but it's a demonstration that we are willing to do what it takes. And that political courage is invisible.
Hmm. I might just end it there because we're running out of time. Thank you very much, Oscar.
Thank you as well, Denise.
No, sorry, it was too short, Oscar. Let's have another conversation.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. We're running very short on time, but very quickly, personal question, how would you define happiness?
you always save the good ones for a Friday, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
I'd describe happiness as hope. So in any circumstance, if you have hope for your future, then no matter whether you've actually got circumstantially some really crappy circumstances, if you've got hope, you can be happy.
Mm, beautiful. We'll be talking with you next week, Denise. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. See ya.
Bye.
The National Party's Denise Lee on 95 BFM.